When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Think about it. Deep conversations with Uli Bear on big ideas and great books.
Are you too deeply occupied to say if my verse is alive? This is from a letter that Emily Dickinson wrote in 1862 at age 32 to Thomas Wentworth Higginson. He was an editor, an abolitionist, an activist, and a soldier who'd encouraged young people to write something for publication in the Atlantic Monthly. I talked to Brenda Wineapple, who wrote a book called White Heat, The Friendship of Emily Dickinson and Thomas Wentworth Higginson, during the lockdown right now. So I called her on the phone to talk about Dickinson and what it means to write to somebody to understand whether they're too busy to acknowledge one's writings and whether it is alive. Dickinson is known to us as someone who spent most of her adult life in her father's home, and part of it just in her bedroom, withdrawn, secluded, separated from the world. But Brenda explained to me that it is not so simple, that there's always been this impulse in America and for Americans and for America to withdraw from the world, to remain disengaged, to draw inward, to separate oneself. But that for Dickinson, this separation of the world and oneself was not something she could achieve simply, but instead turned to Higginson, who's been largely reduced to a footnote in literary history, and who was a remarkable man. And Dickinson turned to him to get published. So Brenda wrote this book called White Heat to understand the friendship of Emily Dickinson and Thomas Wentworth Higginson, and to give him his deserved status in literary and in American history. Brenda's written other books, most recently called Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson, and before that, a book called Nathaniel Hawthorne, A Life. Her book on Dickinson and Higginson was a finalist for the National Books Critics Circle Award. I spoke to her during the lockdown right now. So of course, on my mind was the question of what does it mean to be writing in solitude and not to be reached by others? I'd spent the first few weeks of the lockdown reading Dickinson and editing a small book called Dickinson on Love, because I wanted something to provide maybe consolation or solace. I got something a little bit wrong about Dickinson, about thinking the poetry is maybe tentative, searching. And Brenda helped me understand that it's actually entirely certain of itself, that it is strong in the best sense of that word, and that Dickinson's poetry, while not easy, may be something that can allow us to understand what it means to be ourselves and engage with the world on our own terms. Thank you for listening to the Think About It podcast, and I hope you'll enjoy this episode on America's greatest poet, Emily Dickinson.
Great. So, Brenda, I'm so happy, first of all, that you're on the podcast today. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. It's a treat to be here.
So we're both in New York City, but of course, socially distanced in this time, sort of sitting in our own places and in our apartments. And you've written several books that I really greatly admire. Your book on Hawthorne, Alive, I love, and then this book that really got me interested, reinterested in Emily Dickinson, is your book called White Heat, The Friendship of Emily Dickinson and Thomas Wentworth Higginson, which, as you said, is not a biography. It's a way of maybe thinking about mm-hmm. this friendship between right. people. And I was quite interested in sort of asking you, first of all, how you got interested in this pair, which is, the poet and her editor friend, this action-minded, really interesting person who you give this incredible life to in this book mm-hmm. without mm-hmm. writing a biography. I was mm-hmm. interested first how you got interested in the two of them, because this is not a book about Dickinson or about Higginson. This is a book about their relationship.
Right. Well, thanks so much for having me. And it's an interesting question because, my background is in literature, and I've written a lot about literary matters and figures and conflicts. And of course, everyone who is interested in literature, poetry, and writing wants to write about Emily Dickinson. But she's one of the most slippery and cryptic people that there are. And there's very, very little known about her. And most of what we have that surrounds her life or her artistic method is really speculation. So putting that aside, I would also say you mentioned my Hawthorne book. And because of my work on Hawthorne and because I edited a group of poems by John Greenleaf Whittier, I'd always come across Thomas Wentworth Higginson. And from the Dickinson angle, I'd always heard that he was a kind of bullet-headed Victorian editor who didn't understand her at all. And since I begin all my books with a question, it began to bother me the more I learned about Higginson. And I thought, you know, if we respect Emily Dickinson, if we think she is an original and fresh mind, if we think that she uses language in these exceptional ways, if we think that she's one of the mavericks of not just the 19th century, but the 20th and 21st in American letters, why don't we respect her choice of friend? Because she chose him to be a friend. And it was that question that really kind of launched the book. And it was a hunch. And I remember telling people when I started the investigation, the research for the book, and in fact, a very eminent poet and I were having lunch, and he shall be nameless. And I said, he asked me what I was working on. And I told him the friendship of Dickinson and this man, Thomas Wentworth Higginson. And he said, oh, Thomas Higginson, if she'd only written to Emerson instead of Higginson, you know. And I thought, you know, it's, we're so prejudiced, really, and we're basically. And I thought about what he said, and I encountered over the years that quite a bit. And I thought, you know, what people are really saying, they're really saying, if she had only written to me, I would have understood her.
right. It's interesting that you said you started with the question of this was Dickinson mm-hmm. at age 30. To her choice to write to Higginson, she could have written as a beat to other people.
Exactly, she had a very wide range of reading. Her father was very well connected in politics. She was well known. Her family was well known in Amherst, Massachusetts, and she could have reached out to anyone she wanted. But she chose him. I mean, that's what's so remarkable and so interesting. I should add one thing, and another thing that's interesting, and it tells us something about the state of the academy, such as it is, and that is a historian, particularly scholarly historians, knew who Thomas Wentworth Higginson was. They weren't as interested in Emily Dickinson, whereas literary people, particularly literary scholars, didn't really know who Higginson was, except in terms of his relationship to Dickinson, and they thought of him as I said, a bowdlerizer. So it's very interesting because that also points to the kind of separation that we have in our thinking when it comes to either historical figures or literary figures and their contribution. And it always seemed to me that the two really interact much more than we think they do. You mentioned Hawthorne. I'll mention Hawthorne again. And that is, you know, one of Hawthorne's dearest friends was the president of the United States, Franklin Pierce. I mean, it's hard to think about, really, but they were very close.
And what you're saying, the division or the separation of history, let's say history, politics, what happens in the mm-hmm. real world, and literature as sort of something of the mind, of the imagination, and Dickinson mm-hmm. becomes the figure for a lot of people. She has is the figure. It's very hard to counter this, that she is the embodiment, let's say in the best sense, she's the embodiment of poetry incarnate. She herself is poetry. Yes. She's moved from the world, from worldly concerns, politics, history. And you're saying, actually, she writes to this man who is very much in the world and who historians know, because she has a really critical role in the shaping of our country and the politics of both New England and the Civil War, et cetera. So he's a man of action in a way, an activist on behalf of abolition.
And if you, yes. And in a sense, you could say she, I mean, you could sort of reverse the terms too. And you could say that as one who loved language, as much as she did, she said her lexicon was her only companion. She liked to exaggerate. But you could say that she was an activist too, because her realm of activity was in words and language and the lexicon. And you could say his realm, Higginson's realm, was the realm of imagination, because it takes a certain imagination to see the country going and developing in a different direction than the direction that it had been, which was slavery. And he imagined an emancipated world and an emancipated group of people. So it's very interesting. And you realize that these oppositions may not be as opposed as we think.
But that's interesting. You're saying that she used language in an activist sense, actually, to reimagine or to imagine a world. And he he did the same thing. He was a writer. And from your book, I learned that he'd written these really important pieces about his opposition to slavery, his opposition to the Fugitive Slave Act, which compromised the entire country, of course, and then drew the Northeast into the same battles. Then he, and there's a line in your book, which I really, there's a lot of lines in your book I really liked. And there's one interesting one where you say that Higginson admired the strength, Emily Dickinson's strength to withstand the world, that it wasn't weakness, that she didn't retreat. And I think part of what I really loved about your book is that you say it is not the woman dressed in alabaster white who retreats and is afraid of the world, timid in the attic there in Amherst, but rather that he said it takes strength to withstand the world and not to be drawn back to the field of action all the time.
Yes, and I think that when people ask me what she saw in him was a kind of mirror, mirroring in a different domain of her own strength. And I think it took strength, both of them, as I said, took strength, activism, and imagination. And, you know, I'm sorry to quote from my own kind of ideas and sense, but, you know, I basically, early on in the book, as you know, I said that to a certain extent, that fantasy of isolation and the fantasy of intervention, you know, is very much part of an American body politic and an American literary tradition. But they're fantasies, and we're both a little bit reclusive and activist, both of us, you know, all of us in some fashion or another. And you can see that really in terms of American foreign policy, and you can see it in terms of American literary history. So it's really kind of interesting. And then those are the questions that motivated me. And at the same time, I was very interested, as you know, and in her poetry itself. And the poetry itself, there's really nothing like it.
Before we get to the poetry, this this link you just said, which in between seclusion and engagement or activism withdrawal. So you have people. I'm just thinking, you have Jefferson, who builds Monticello to retreat and is also so much in the world as statesman, diplomat, etc. You have
He lives in France. I mean, he loves the French.
You have Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. So Walden is both a retreat, which is a book that is supposed to be about a deeper immersion in the world. And as we know, Thoreau, who gives us an idea of civil disobedience, who's very engaged in the issue of slavery and abolition. So who's
not? Yes, he admired John Brown. That's right.
He admired John Brown, as does Higginson. So these people are not removed, but feel that you have to find a place in the kind of hustle and bustle of American life, especially kind of 19th century.
Yeah.
And how do you get to, so you're saying you want to maybe breakdown, maybe not the right word, but the opposition between engagement and withdrawal, which Dickinson is always put on the one side of. And you're saying this letter, when it starts, it alerts us to the fact she's very much engaged with the world.
Yes, exactly. I think that's absolutely true. And I think that anyone who writes in one form or another is engaged with the world. I mean, the act of writing, you know, language is a social acquisition. It, you know, she has the poem that famously begins, "This is my letter to the world." And so that in some sense, absolutely, there has to be that kind of engagement. And then just from in a more literal level, I mean, her own family was very involved in the goings on in Amherst. And beyond that, her father was in Congress. I mean, he was, you know, and she and her sister accompanied at one point her father to Washington. I mean, so there was much more that was going on in the Dickinson household and than we perhaps had thought about. But also, I think we just have a tendency to want to see things either one way or another way. And, you know, and we see the fallacy of that. If you again go back to the whole idea of isolationism, it just doesn't work. It didn't work for Thoreau, and it doesn't work for, you know, the United States in 1941. I mean, so it's a very interesting phenomenon, really. And as I say, anybody who writes knows that you are responding to and integrated in the world in ways you may not even understand. And certainly, I think she does and did. And she was an avid reader. She read everything. And the reason that she contacted Higginson was because she was reading him. So even if we don't read him, she did. And it's important to respect her, I think.
Are you too deeply occupied to say if my verse is alive?
And he had written this little invitation, say, letters to a young contributor, or is that what it's where he said, how do you submit something for a publication? So there's an assumption that she wrote these letters, although she published not even a handful of poems in her lifetime. So, but there's the sentence that you start the book out, or part of the book, is, are you too deeply occupied to say if my verse is alive?
Yeah.
I thought this question is interesting in some ways. She knows she's preparing this. She's sending it to him unsolicited and doesn't even quite say who she is, and says, are you too deeply occupied, already putting into this little tiny question, this tension, are you too much in the world to tell me whether I'm alive? Which is quite interesting. So this deeply occupied, he could say, I'm too busy to read some person's poems that I don't even know about. And she's sort of teasing him almost.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. And, because she didn't sign the letter. And instead she put a tiny little calling card within an envelope. And she put that sealed envelope within the larger envelope that she wrote to him, so that when he read the letter that begins, are you too occupied to see if my verse is alive? It wasn't signed, but there was another tiny envelope within the larger one that said, Miss Emily Dickinson. It's, you know, very coy, very flirtatious.
Right. Already. And what's interesting when I think about how you open up the book to say my verse is alive, she thought, and Dickinson, this is, I think, one of the great things about her poetry, it's so vibrant and it is alive.
Yes.
If anything, it is, and it's a lot of it is about death, as we know, or the poem you just referred to, this poem, This Is My Letter to the World. Mm-hmm. And then the second line of that poem, I think, is, this is my poem, this is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. Mm-hmm. But by opening that up, it's as if this is not even a relevant complaint. The world doesn't address her, so she will address and create the world. Idea we have of Dickinson that she couldn't get in touch with the world, she said, that is not my issue, my concern. Of course, the world will not address me, or nature will not address me. It is on me to give language to this experience, and therefore will the world into existence.
Mm-hmm, right. And it's exactly right. I think that's a great point, Uli, because what she does is she wills a world into existence through language. She creates an entire universe of sound and of sense and of meaning.
And when you looked at her sort of between the two of them, and I do want to give Higginson his due, actually, if you can give me a bit of a sense mm-hmm. of what else he was engaged in. And as you said, Dickinson is using the language that had been given to her, like all of us. We all learn language at home, in school, mm-hmm. and through reading. Those are probably the mm-hmm. Or for her also, for a while, going to church. At some point, she stopped going to church with her family.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is probably mm-hmm. the language that's in her mental universe at this point. Her how she was raised, then she goes to school for a while, and she reads quite a bit. Shakespeare. Higginson, his world is the world of this, as we said, he's a writer who writes these essays to move people to take positions. So it's...
Well, not entirely. I mean, some of the essays that he loved the best and that actually Thoreau loved the best were really what we call today nature essays, you know, beautiful essays about, walking through nature, about snowfall. So his range in terms of his writing is very large. And of course, during the Civil War, when he was part of the first federally authorized regiment of black soldiers stationed in the South, which was very dangerous at that particular time, obviously, he went around and he transcribed many of the songs that the formerly enslaved were singing, the people, down the South. So we have a lot of material coming from him just because he was interested in the way a language works and music works. At the same time, as you say, he did write essays for the Atlantic Monthly, it's the same magazine as today, about slave insurrections, and was rather pro, which is kind of astonishing. So he had a very varied career. He was highly educated. Thoreau said that Higginson was the only person with seven languages who battered down a door in the Boston jail to free a fugitive slave. So you have here again these contradictions. And he'd also been a Unitarian minister, but he left the church because it wasn't radical enough for him. And so for him, when the Civil War came, he was very eager to join this very unusual, as I said, federally authorized regiment of black troops in the South, where he was stationed in Beaufort, South Carolina. So it's around that time that he was also writing essays for the Atlantic Monthly. And as you mentioned, one of the ones is Letters to a Young Contributor, where he was saying, if you want to write, it would be something that I might tell my writing students today. If you want to be published, this is how you go about proposing what it is you want to do. This is your pitch. This is how you approach the editor. First of all, you read the magazine. Second of all, when you write something, you use a clean sheet of paper, no blotches, and on and on. And he said, charge your, sentences with life. And apparently that's what finally moved Dickinson to get in touch with him. But it's also interesting, one more thing that's interesting about this is the fact that after he published that essay in The Atlantic, he got a huge outpouring of mail, precisely because of the advice he's given. But of all the mail he received, he answered Dickinson. And then Dickinson, who was very, very capable of shutting the door. She wrote, "The soul selects its own society," and then shuts the door. When she wrote him and he answered, she wrote him back. In other words, if he had said something that was offensive or annoying or, boneheaded, she wouldn't have answered.
And she writes back, and so there's this kind of a kind of mystery at the center of this. And right from the beginning, she asked them, mm-hmm. is my verse alive? And then she says also, mm-hmm. publication was foreign to my thought. I'm not interested really in publishing. So she's writing to a man, mm-hmm. this is how you can get published. That's presumably the ostensible reason. And she writes in this little enigmatic packet with an envelope, mm-hmm. of a card inside a letter that he has to open. He writes back, we don't know his letters. And then she keeps on sending him poems throughout her life. There's a couple other people in her life, in her orbit, who she also shares poetry with her.
That's right. But very few. I mean, there's her sister-in-law with whom she's very close. I mean, in sort of erotically charged relationship. There's some friends from school that she had, and, you know, a few cousins. But very, very few. And the bulk of her poetry was either given or sent to her sister-in-law, who happened to live next door, married to her brother, or to Thomas Higginson. I mean, it's really remarkable when you think of the sheer volume of poetry that she sent to him.
And these poems are shared, and we don't talk, did you get a sense of what her objective is in sharing it with him? Does she want feedback? There's some of the poems are so startling in their certainty.
Yeah.
That, mm-hmm. you think, what does she want? Someone to edit this? Unlikely, right? And we know that Higginson at some point tries his hand a little tiny bit and shifts a couple of things or changes a few words later on when he publishes after her death. But do you think she wants feedback or engagement, or does she? So this is, I think, a kind of a question for all the writers who do not publish the Kafkas of the world or something. Who also does the same thing, who entrusts his writing to his best friend, Max Brod, and says, please burn all of it. And Max Brod turns around and publishes all of it. So what does she want to engage, do you think, by giving? And Sue is probably a different relationship than her sister-in-law, who she has this really charged relationship with.
Yeah, but I think it was pretty charged with Higginson, too. I mean, one doesn't exclude another necessarily. I mean, later on in her life, she has a very charged erotic relationship with an older man, Judge Lord. So there's a kind of, you know, polymorphousness here. But what does she want? I think she wants understanding. I think she wants engagement. I think she wants admiration. I think she wants a host of things that are, to a certain extent, explicable, as I said, engagement, understanding, and some things, and I don't think really advice, because I don't think she, I think she humors advice. I think she knows what she's doing, but I think she felt very close to Higginson, and at a certain point, she credits him with getting her through some really bleak times in her life. And, you know, it's hard for us to understand that in that sense. But you have to also remember, and here's a problem that often, and when we try to do any kind of historical excavation, that we come across, and that is his letters to her are largely missing. And that's really unfortunate. Maybe they'll turn up someday, but I tend to doubt it. So we would have a better sense of what he was giving her and what she got from him if we had both sides of the correspondence. So as it is, it's easy for us, as we do with Dickinson all the time, to project onto her our own sensibility. So that's why I have to be a little kind of cautious in answering fully what it was she wanted. All I can say is, whatever it was, she was getting it, or she wouldn't have constantly asked him to come to Amherst. She wouldn't have kept writing him. She wouldn't have kept sending poems to him. So I think the safest thing is to say she recognized something in him, and he recognized something in her that they both shared, because to a certain extent, in different ways, they were both outsiders to the kind of status quo that we associate with society, and especially that's true after the Civil War, but even before.
And I think that point you make, that her withdrawal from the world is not out of weakness. It is not that she wants to not engage with the world. She actually, and I think this is, her poetry is this incredibly strong engagement with herself and with the world. And there's a line I picked out of your book, which I thought was really funny, made me laugh, actually. It's Emily Dickinson's line, and it says, "I'm out with lanterns looking for myself." And I love this line of someone going out to try to find herself.
Yeah.
And when I was just listening to you, I thought, I'm just asking you because I feel, of course, you know, this is a bit presumptuous, in the position of Higginson, of receiving that person saying, what does she want? And probably the wrong question, but she's sending us, she left us these poems, so around 800 poems, and we're sitting here thinking, what could we possibly say
to her?
To her.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. But, you know, there's a couple of things that something you're saying is really important, I think. Well, two things. One is that line, I'm out with my lantern looking for myself. It's so modern. It's like someone could say this today. I mean, it doesn't have a kind of, you know, stilted, you know, our kind of stereotype and stilted notion of the 19th century. She's very fresh. She's very modern. The other thing I'd say that comes out of your very astute comment is that Higginson, to a certain extent, is closer to the reader. In other words, he's closer to us because we identify to a certain extent with him because we understand the way in which he lives so much in time. He's so much part of history. He makes himself part of history. And whereas Dickinson, as a kind of both as a lyric poet, but also as a symbol of lyric poetry, she automatically lives outside of time. You know, she seems to kind of speak to us across the borders of chronology, and she's right there almost in her own brain. So she, you know, is two really different ways of being in the world that are ultimately compatible, because we, you know, our dreams are sort of more like lyric poetry, but you know, our daily lives, you know, how are we going to get the groceries during a pandemic, much more live in history.
There's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us, we can find no scar, but internal difference, where the meanings are. None may teach it, any, 'tis the seal of despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens. Shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death.
I was just thinking, when before you said getting groceries in the pandemic, we're both sitting in our seclusion here. What I found really interesting rereading a lot of her poems in the last couple of days is that there's a lot of times they circle around a kind of emptiness. There's a kind of ellipsis in the middle. Mm-hmm. So one of the poems you sent me is, there's a certain slant of light. It ends in the last stanza. It ends on, there's a before and an after, and we're supposed to be in the time, in the present, but we don't know what that is. So it says, when it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. But between when it comes and when it goes, presumably that's where we are in the poem. But that time is not the time of where we can just make choices and be active. It's sort of, it's the time of, in one of the other poems of, you know, it's, you know, after after great pain, stillness comes. So in some ways we're getting our groceries in the pandemic. Okay, we want to do something, but we also know we are outside of time during a moment of crisis and trauma. We actually, it's way too present. So I some of the poems seem to be in this kind of space. It's not just the world is maybe too much with us or something, but it's that actually to know where we are in the world would mean to know where we sit with pain and that experience, or she stays with loss, where most poems, where most people probably shrink away, where we...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's absolutely true. And the interesting thing about, you say, you know, in the poem, there's a certain slant of light, and you go to the, you know, last stanza when she talks about when it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, just like the distance and the look of death. What's very interesting, and obviously I'm not reading it well, but in those four lines, you know, between the second and third line, only four lines, there's a kind of pause in reading. Shadows hold their breath when it goes, just like the distance on the look of death. And the line shadows dash hold their breath dash, her uses of the dash in that particular case gives us that sense that you're talking about of the kind of the way in which we feel, even though it doesn't, but we experience that pause or that stopping of time. And the same thing is true too in the poem you quote, after great pain, a formal feeling comes, where she talks about, you know, this is the hour of lead, you know, great line, the hour of lead, you know, remember if outlived. And we only can know that after the fact, really. The living is different than the remembering, which is, you know, so perceptive in that particular case.
And in that poem, the line you just quoted, from which is from After Great Pain, this is the hour of lead, remembered if outlived, which is that we may remember our loss if we, but outliving is not necessarily triumphantly surviving. It just means we live on past this moment and then remember it if outlived. It's not when outlived. There's also a strange idea that the hour, and I, when you were saying about the other poem, that there's a kind of a break between the line, hold their breath when it goes. There's a sense when I'm listening now, when you were just saying these lines, as if with Dickinson, you're never quite sure whether this next pair of words, not even a full line, is the last one. Whether this exhale.
No, that's a great point. Absolutely. Very definitely.
In the same poem, After Great Pain, the second middle sentence, the feet mechanical go round. There's a sense in which every step that she takes, every new word, is something you almost feel kind of grateful that she comes up with a word, because it's not sure there's going to be another word. This is it. This is, we are at the edge of death or loss or our own mourning, and then we may not outlive this. And
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, she squeezes every sort of bit of meaning out of a single word, because when you think about it, just in terms of the, you know, the length of the lines or the length of the poem are typically very, very short. But I think that one of the beauties of the Dickinson corpus, or the, you know, poetry itself, is that the sort of, either you call it elliptical, I call it open-ended quality. And there's a way in which sometimes what we think she's saying means just the opposite. And what I'm thinking of is a great poem, I Felt a Funeral in My Brain.
I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as all the heavens were a bell and being but an ear. And I, and silence, some strange race, wrecked, solitary, here. and then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then.
You know, people might know it, you know, mourners to and fro kept treading till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And the rest of the poem proceeds externally. The external metaphor is like a funeral, people walking around a casket and then a burial. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul. And then you have, you know, the coffin going into the ground. And the last, I've always admired really the last stanza, where she writes, and then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing that. And if I read it like that, you know, it feels like an end to something, and finished knowing, right? Because it was a funeral in my brain, and something happened. But another way to read that, those same lines, is to say, and then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge and finished knowing. Then, as if to say, yeah. And then, you know, and whoa, what happened then? Something else would happen, so that there's an opening rather than a closing.
Right. And it's interesting. It's probably the, I wonder whether some of in this last stanza, it's such a graphic image, a plank in reason. This is a funeral, mm-hmm. and they're sitting around they're standing around a box, not even a casket,
right.
Lift a box, it creaks. And then as if there's a depth to the despair of death, there's something, and it doesn't become, and that's why I think, of course, in Dickinson, so many things are capitalized, and then it hit a world at every plunge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's probably the imagery that's familiar to her readers from the Bible. It's kind of biblical imagery. There's life after death.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not life after death in this way. I drop down and down and hit a world at every plunge. This kind of, the lines themselves go kind of up and down. I drop down and down and hit a world and finish knowing. And it's not sort of the Christian redemptive story that there's life after death or Christ is risen for our sins or something, but something like what you're saying, and finish knowing then.
And in that particular sense, the funeral in my brain, you know, and that sense was breaking through, could be something, a different, the poem in that particular context could be about a different kind of knowing.
Yeah.
You know, that really, that there are different ways of knowing. And, you know, she says, and then a plank in reason broke.
Yeah.
So that there's, you know, as she says in another often quoted poem, much madness is divinest sense. You know, so that here, if she were, you know, in Burt's, madness is divinest sense.
Yeah.
And so in that particular case, reason breaking down may give us a different way of knowing.
And it's interesting that she goes so much to, it's as if she goes to death, funerals, sort of loss. And she experienced loss in her life. Her nephew died. She was very taken with that, very fond of him, writes these incredibly moving letters to her sister-in-law. And she knows about the soldiers dying in the Civil War. The son of the president of Memphis College dies. She's very aware of that. So there's, it's never abstract, it seems. And I think this is part of what you're trying to do, to say, strangely enough, even in loss and grief, we are so terribly acutely alive, because we're so we're so in pain. And there's something quite interesting what that is, what pain for her is sort of, it's not, she uses other word, transport a lot. It's not that pain defeats us, but it gets us to another place, hopefully. I don't know if hopefully is probably not a Dickinsonian idea at all.
Well, yeah, but I think that, yes, I mean, if we were to see her poems along a single trajectory, and I feel that I personally can't, because there are a lot of poems that are not about pain. They're about ecstasy. They're about ways of seeing. They're about, as I said, you know, different ways of knowing. I quoted before, Much Madness, you know, is divinest sense, you know, to a discerning eye, much sense, the starkest madness. At the same time, she'll say the first line of another poem, you know, this world is not conclusion. In other words, you know, there are different ways of approaching, there are different ways of apprehending. And I suppose, absolutely, you're right. I mean, death was all around her. It's all around us now, for sure. And, you know, and you're right, the death of her nephew, but that was later in her life. But nonetheless, it was difficult. You know, the mortality rates in middle of the 19th century in America are high. But there are other things that also enthrall her, you know, a bird walking down the, you know, the walk, as she talks about. So in that sense, as I say, it's an interesting kind of mix, it seems to me.
But I like this, actually, that it's interesting that we're going from this sort of, she investigates in a pretty unflinching way, death and loss, but then ecstasy of life, which she finds in the bumblebees around her, and it reminds me of Dickinson, Higgins, and you actually quote that. He says, if I could only make you smell the azaleas in my prose. He wants that vividness. Somehow, with Dickinson, you get a bit of a sense, the bobolink or whatever bird she finds is one of my you feel the bird hopping in her poem. It's not, there's something so vivid about it. And to go back.
No, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. You know, it's true.
It's also funny because she drops in these things like the bobolink, of course, I like because I like the word and it's not a bird we. But they drop in almost as if there's kind of the materiality of the world just so present to her.
Exactly. That's right. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's exactly right. That materiality of the world, you know, what trees look like from, you know, on a solitary acre, you know, the feeling of the wind, the way a rose is in bloom. I mean, all of those kinds of things, you know, her senses are so highly tuned in that particular regard. Absolutely. I think that you're right. You know, the sense of what it's like in the fall, what summer's like, all of that, this, you know, change of the seasons, really. It's really rather remarkable.
And it's startling. And you said earlier, it's kind of, she can sound quite modern to us.
Definitely.
But there's something startling when it's after great pain, a formal feeling comes, the nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. There's something so vivid about that image, your nerves on edge kind of, but at the same time kind of erect, sitting there like in this with the heaviness. Or in the other poem that you just quoted, this world is not conclusion. At the end, he says, narcotics cannot still the tooth that nibbles at the soul.
I know, what a line.
It's what a line. I mean,
the tooth that nibbles at the soul. You know, it almost makes your skin crawl. It's so powerful.
I like it. And I think, like in the other poem, you said it's the ending with the then that the tooth that nibbles at the soul is maybe our awareness of our mortality that keeps us alive. It's not that we actually want to do away with this. The whole poem is about that. Nothing works, philosophy, nothing will satisfy. There's something in us that we want to know ourselves. And that's for her, it can't be stilled.
That's right. And for her, you could say, I mean, not to be too reductive, but it is imagination. You know, it's that kind of sensibility. It's an ability, you know, whether you think in religious terms or secular terms, it's the ability to imagine alternatives, you know, and I think that's what's exciting to her in language itself, because if we know any single word, you know, especially, for example, if you're translating, you know, from one language to another, you realize there's so many nuances, so many meanings, you know, so many connotations, and that each word opens itself to sort of a sense of excitement and possibility.
It's,
you know, I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, she writes.
And the idea that we could dwell in possibility then, and not prose, not the mundane. And I think she says, I think in your book, she writes to Sue and says, we are the only poets and everyone else is prose.
Right.
Almost a kind of sly and funny kind of put down, or say people who go on. And she, in a few words, gives you the immediacy of life.
Yes. And that's a good point too, because, you know, and she's a very witty writer. She's funny. I mean, she has a great sense of humor. This was, you know, one forgets if one focuses too much on pain or death, one thinks of her, you know, as, well, is she very morbid? Is she, you know, very dark? And that's really not who she is entirely. She has a tremendous sense of wit. She's very much like the sort of 17th century poet in that particular regard. And she held them in high esteem, whether it was, you know, Donne or Herbert or whomever. And certainly Shakespeare, and you think of Shakespeare as being very funny at times, serious and funny.
I think as a poet, she's quite unusual to have this humor and to be so close to life. And at the same time, was it this kind of the tooth that nibbles at the soul? She's also, there's so much active thinking going on in her poems, but it doesn't feel like academic or religious or scholarly thinking at all. It's someone trying to find her place or to know her place in the world, I guess.
I think she has a sense of her place in the world. I mean, she may have that lantern looking for herself, but again, she's also being coy. I mean, somebody who says that has a very strong sense of self, not a weak sense of self, you know what I mean, in that particular regard, so that she is able to project. And this is what she was very good at, projecting persona. And she takes on in her poetry, as well as in her letters, various personas. She's not always herself. And as she tells Higginson at one point, you know, when she uses the first person, I, she means not herself. And it's, you know, in a sense, the first lesson of a literary critic is not to take the first person as, you know, the same as the author. And, you know, although there are similarities, obviously, she's very aware of what she's doing. And in that sense, she is, in a sense, playing and as a dramatist would play.
And it's, when you're saying she has a very strong sense of self, when we read her, there's a kind of... I do go back to identifying with Higginson. There's a kind of awe that I think I think he writes in the 1890s or something, right? He still says this is it shook him. This shook him, and he never quite was able to make sense of it entirely. Then he dedicated himself to publishing her quite a bit after her death, and with one of her sisters and her brother's lover. So they all sort of get together and do this complicated project of publishing Emily Dickinson, which lasts for 100 years or so. But she has a strong sense of self. When you read her, you feel you're in conversation with somebody. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like someone trying to talk to you.
Yes. She's very present. She's not alien to you. I mean, people might read other American poets, like say, I don't know, T.S. Eliot, and for many people, he's removed from you, not from me. I find him not that way, but I know that many people do. But there's a way in which it seems as though she's writing from inside of you, the reader, which is kind of remarkable, because by the same token, people will, you know, gladly admit that they don't understand everything she's writing. But one of the things I find interesting about Dickinson is that her work reaches out to a very broad demographic, you know, whether, you know, certainly it's international. Yeah. Certainly it cuts across, you know, youth and age. It's enormously broad. People who don't necessarily like poetry, people who love poetry. I mean, and that ability to grab the reader is phenomenal. And she's one of the poets. I mean, there's constantly speculation, as we said before. There are movies about her, TV shows. You know, who was this woman? And it's not just because she was a recluse to a certain extent, although I would argue she wasn't, but it's because people find something in her poetry. Not every poem, but there are enough of them. And they know she's speaking directly to them without a filter, which is remarkable that she was able to do that. And I think she knew she was able to do it. And there are those who say, you know, her not publishing, her choosing not to publish in traditional ways was also a way of publishing. And I would even say that her shying away from publicity was a way of garnering publicity. You think of more contemporary examples. You think of your J.D. Salingers or your Thomas Pynchon or your Don DeLillo. You know, there's an aura to he or she who stays apart.
It's when you said she appeals to so many people, I'm interested mm-hmm. in this idea when she's very present to you as a mm-hmm. one of her readers. And it's interesting when we think of other people who we want to spend time with, we don't expect them to be fully transparent to us and
that's true.
To just say things we anticipate. We actually expect rather the opposite. I want my friends to tell me things that I don't totally expect. And right. funny way, poets, when people say, oh, Dickinson is difficult, you should say, well, one would say, well, that is actually the encounter with another person. That,
yeah.
But I think the strength of her is it's not just baffling, confused, that what you said earlier when you corrected me, which I think you're right, she knew who she was.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's not a confused person out there sitting in an attic, you know, uh-huh. scribbling away. It's like, no, we want to learn something about her because we have a sense of strength that's really unusual.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I didn't mean to correct you. I just have a different point of view.
I actually think you're right. I kind of misstated that. She's not, because there is something when I said much earlier, she kind of feels like every word could be the last one, but there is no lack of certainty or sureness of how she proceeds. There's not mm-hmm. nothing tentative.
Yeah. No. I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, I think that the, you know, fault is in ourselves, you know, and our own ambivalences and our lack of certainty in that particular, you know, case. Absolutely. I think that's, you know, true. And in thinking, she has this in one of her letters, she says, and I've always taken great kind of heart from this. She says, no is the wildest word in the language. And one of the abilities that she developed and she had was the ability to say no. And that's very strong when you think about it. You know, people say yes all the time just to get by, to make other people happy, you know, for all kinds of reasons. It's placating. She really had the capability of saying no. So what she said no to was also any kind of traditional poetic form, any kind of traditional sense of how poetry should work or what the subject of poetry should be. She was willing to counter that. And that, to me, that is a remarkable strength. Really, to be able to do that and to pull that off. And then if you sort of think of what it was like to be in Amherst, small town, kind of parochial college town, to be a woman, you know, all the kinds of things that we think of as strictures in society, she kind of converted them all into assets. And lest we think of her as kind of, you know, kind of simpy and fragile and reclusive, we also can think of her as kind of powerful and angry even.
Right. I think she has served in a way. And I think that in the best sense, actually, for people to actually also find their own voices. So she's been read as a kind of a paragon of for feminist scholars. There's huge debates about that. So Susan Howe and sort of Gilbert and Guba are kind of arguing, is she the mad woman in the attic, or is she actually a voice of strength?
Right. But then, you know, it's so interesting. Absolutely. You know, the whole sort of mad woman in the attic thing, which is, you know, it's kind of groundbreaking when it happened. And then it seems almost like a trap. But by the same token, then you have people who kind of, what's the word I want, kind of absorb Dickinson and think they become her, and that, you know, they speak for her in a certain way, you know, and what we, the kind of language we've used today is colonize her voice or appropriate it. And, you know, the interesting thing, as you have done when you sit and look at her poems, you just can't do that. You just really can't do that. And, you know, I mean, it sort of happened to me as a writer in a sense of, you know, unbelievable humility and inadequacy of trying to say what she said so much better. You just can't.
But it's nice you do this in the book. There's actually a chapter in your book where you say she kind of interrupts your narrative. You want to tell the
story. She stops it, yeah.
And then you say you can't totally assimilate her. And I also like this part, what you keep open is the great mystery of a friendship. That actually, because as you said, until really pretty much until your book, sort of Higginson is dismissed as a bit, sort of he's this guy who lets us encounter Emily Dickinson, otherwise not much worth there. So, and you're saying, no, actually he's his own person as well. He grows in this relationship. And it is not for us to say, oh, Dickinson turned to this second rate person. You should have, as you said, one of your poet friends, and you should have turned to Emerson. When Emerson visits the Dickinson homestead, she supposedly declines to come downstairs and meet him.
Right. That's right. And, you know, second rate, who's to say second rate, but right. We would be better. And as I said, you know, to me, I mean, and he was well known in his time. I mean, we're so time bound. He was famous in his own time.
Right.
And he was heroic. I mean, he's not anti-slavery. He's an abolitionist. He's really on the edge of things, and he's really out there in so many ways. So, you know, second rate. Well, okay. So he wasn't, I don't know. He wasn't Melville, but she didn't want Melville really. And, you know, Melville was actually very conservative. So it's a whole different kind of idea we have. But also that comes from a lot of, you know, literary propaganda about what happened to her verse and who did what. And, you know, as you said, in the 1890s, when he was writing an introduction to the first volume published of his verse, you know, he basically said that when he read her, I mean, he likened her, and I think very perceptively, to William Blake. And who can sit down and say, oh, I understand William Blake? You know, it's just another world is opened up, really, and you're awed by it in that sense. And he had told the other editor, Mabel Dodd, Mabel Lewin, after he sort of left, and he left the whole project, because he said, now that the public's ear is open, we should probably leave Dickinson's work alone. In other words, he was very conscious of what it would take to get her published and out in the world. But once that happened, he wasn't really in favor of doing too much editorial surgery, as Dickinson called it. So, you know, we're always content to just have a half a story. But that's what's great for people like me or you. It gives us an opportunity to write a different story.
Have you watched any of the adaptations? So Cynthia Nixon did a film, and then there's this pop star, Hailee Steinfeld, who's now in a new show. Both of them based on Dickinson. Have you seen any of those? They're contemporary.
Well, yeah, the the film, and I'm blocking on the name. What is it? Passion, or I forget the name of it now. The one with Cynthia Nixon was Terrence. I'm blocking on it right now. But yeah, I reviewed that for Art Forum. And so I'm very familiar with that. I had to watch it too many times. A lot of work. I didn't realize it would be that much work. And I haven't seen the other rendition of the television program that you mentioned. It got very good reviews and it sounded very, very interesting. But I'm not really that fond of historical reenactments, and the film that we're talking about, I think it was Quiet Passion. I really wasn't enamored of it. I felt that it just really, to my mind, did not capture Dickinson at all. It made her much more like the mad woman in the attic. But I'm different taste.
The one thing I liked about it I liked that they're taking Emily Dickinson and turning it into something. I don't expect them to really recite all the poetry. I thought they got the humor, and they got wit and humor. And there's a bit of a this lingering idea that she was just sad and didn't have a life. And I think that gets corrected to the public.
In that movie, in A Quiet Passion?
No, not in The Quiet Passion. She just
I mean, she was hysterical in that. She had a epileptic or some kind of fit for like 20 minutes, I think. I thought,
repressed that successfully. I only remembered when she was quite witty or something to some suitor in the beginning.
Maybe so. I think the television version or the streaming version is supposed to actually be very witty and kind of very kind of updated. We'll have to watch it at some point.
They sound like 21st century. They definitely, and then that, when I would not stop for death, they actually, death pulls up in a carriage, and it's actually it's quite entertaining what they do.
That sounds rather charming, actually. I like that,
But I was going to ask you something else for people who are listening to this, because for a lot of people, poetry is daunting and difficult. And how would you go about saying to somebody, where do you start with Emily Dickinson? I mean, I have the Harvard University Press Belknap edition here, the tome, it's 800 poems. Like, you have a Bible in your hands and you start at page one in Genesis and then you get to salvation.
But you mean the paperback? You mean the paperback?
I have the hardcover even, and it's so big. And it's like, how do people get into, where do you start with it? Because she's not, Blake has a kind of this mythopoetic universe. You can find your way around characters or people. This is Emily Dickinson. So what would you recommend as a beginning?
Well, it's very hard for me to do that. That's a good question. I guess I would say, to anyone wanting to start, one of two things. One is grab some poetry anthology of American poetry. Probably the anthologists themselves have picked some favorites of theirs that they think will be favorites of yours. The other way, if that doesn't work, there are, the paperback. It is a big paperback, to be sure, but I would just, take a volume like that paperback of Emily Dickinson and open it anywhere. You don't have to start at the beginning and then go to the end. Just open it at random. If that poem on that page and they're short doesn't work for you, go to another page. But probably for the very beginner, I would say, and I think this is probably where I began way back when, with an anthology of poetry. And that's how we all get started, really, because we have a group of poets to choose from, and then we see which ones, their style, their sensibility, their use of language and imagination appeals to us. So that's what I would suggest, and just to feel comfortable taking one or two and then putting it aside, and then another day picking it up again with another one and another two.
Yeah, I think that's to just dip in. I think to get the paperback and dip in. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing to do is to, Emily Dickinson famously put her poems in little packets. She sewed them up and tied them together. Something very tactile. So I think use a pen, mark up your book, put little strips of paper in. I think that's very important to actually make it into a tangible object.
Sure. And it sounds like fun to boot. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Then you feel like it's
make your own little anthology. That's a good idea.
Cut it up and make it into your own. Exactly. And then, while we're wrapping up in this moment of our own enforced seclusion, what are you reading or what are you turning to? Because, sometimes for me, at least this whole week spending it in Dickinson's world, I felt actually kind of invigorated, not consoled, but kind of there's so much energy in her words. It was a nice thing. What are you turning to read to in these days while we're all sort of in lockdown here?
Well, thanks to you, I reopened my Dickinson, and as familiar as I am with her, I thought, my goodness, she is amazing. You know, it's like listening to music. You know, you can have it in your head. You can think you know it. You know the Beethoven symphony, whatever it happens to be. But when you hear it, it's nothing like you remembered. And I felt that way about the poetry. But to be really truthful in these days, novels. I just want to get lost in a novel. That's what I've been doing. But the Dickinson is wonderful. I highly recommend it. You're right. Yeah. The energy is terrific. It's not consoling. It's exhilarating.
Exactly. I think that's what, we can leave our listeners with that idea that this is a poet to actually brings you into life in an urgent way.
Yes, but I'd also suggest Whitman. He'll make you feel better. That will be for your next show.
That'll be for my next show, right? Yeah, he who loves all of America so viscerally, right? Yeah. He has this kind of love.
Yes, he loves us all. He loves us all.
He loves us all. He definitely loves us all, right? She loves us in a slightly bracing way, I think.
That's right. Well, thank you, Uli. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I've enjoyed
every minute.
Thank you so much. And I hope, this will lift at some point and we'll be back in the world of engagement in different ways.
I'll look forward to seeing you in person and continuing the conversation.
So thank you, Brenda, for joining the podcast. Thanks.
Okay. Okay. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.